markets are closed, and we won't know until Tuesday's session if that's a good or bad thing based on the weather happenings in southern Brazil and Argentina. And as long as the crops in those two countries are in the focus of the markets, let's get somebody in here that knows what the heck is going on.
From the wintry flat slopes of the ice-crusted plains via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This afternoon, it's a chat with Dr. Michael Cordonier from Corn and Soybean Advisor, later Kerry Artek from ArtekAdvisory.com. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson, and now the host of AgriTalk, Chip Flory.
All right, Davis. Hey, thank you so much. And happy Martin Luther King Jr. Day, Davis.
Indeed. Same to you, buddy. Same to you.
Yeah.
Big day. Big day.
Absolutely. Time for some reflection on the country and what got us to the where we are today and the civil rights movement of the 60s and what mm-hmm. it meant to every American growing up. And it struck me, and I'm going to talk about this a little bit later, too, but it struck me, Davis, okay. when I was looking at some of the history of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., when he was killed, I was not even 3 years old, and I'm old, man.
All right.
When I put it in that context of my lifetime, mm-hmm. and I think about how the efforts and the messages from Dr. Martin Luther King and how they are still so relevant today, in mm-hmm. many ways, not always, but in many ways. It's really important, and the commitment to nonviolence in the movement that was exhibited
yes.
by Dr. King was a message that was so desperately needed at the time. And when you look at the summer of 2020, 2021, I think it's obvious that commitment to nonviolence could be renewed in this country, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. I agree. And actually, at the bottom of the hour, rather than a market recap, news recap kind of a thing, I've yep. chosen to read an excerpt from Dr. King's letter from a Birmingham jail, which is very Good. Pertinent to, okay, if you want to be involved in civil disobedience, you want to make a statement, here's, in his eyes, the proper way to do it.
Right.
I was fascinated by it.
Good.
So. Stick
Good.
For that.
Good for you.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're doing that. I'm glad that you are doing that.
Yeah, man.
Boy, here we are, 3-day weekend for the markets. And
Woo-hoo.
Everything's going to depend on what's going on down in South America. Isn't that right?
I think so. The land of the eternal Speedo is what I call
the land of the. Is that what you think of when you think of Brazil and Argentina? The land
yes,
of the
I do.
Eternal Speedo?
Yes. I only need one piece of clothes. I may retire down there, yes. That's fine.
Stuff.
I'll be far away. You won't even know.
Yeah. Good. That's great. So here we are, weather market, and just exactly how those rains yep. panned out over the weekend. Going to have a major influence on Tuesday's session that starts later tonight. And just mm-hmm. exactly what the direction in this the corn market and the bean market is going to be, at least through the end of January, at least until we start to roll the combines more aggressively in that Brazilian bean crop and really get a handle on what the final yields are going to be. So a lot to learn yet.
Great.
A lot to learn about the South American production, and we're going to get a really solid baseline of understanding of what is going on down there from Dr. Michael Cordonier coming up in segments 2 and 3. We're going to do the full rundown. And, of course, we got to talk about expansion plans and what's going on with the infrastructure down there. All right, man, let's get to the news. What do you got?
Well, Chip, wheat futures had a tough time dealing with the bigger-than-expected U.S. and global carryover estimates and with the bigger-than-expected winter wheat seedings estimate from USDA on Friday. Traders noted the increase in winter wheat acres took some pressure off the spring wheat market to attract more acres for 2022. The result was the lowest close in front-month spring wheat futures since September 21. And Friday's session high open and session low close in spring wheat points to a test of support at the September low at 8.51 even. Traders do say eventually the market will have to pay attention to tough, hard red winter wheat crop conditions, but that could still be a month or even longer away. On Friday, March hard red winter wheat futures were 14 and three quarters lower, 745. March soft red wheat slipped 5 1/4 to 741 1/2. March spring wheat closed at 878 1/4, down 17 1/4 cents, Chip.
And I know I talked about this on Friday, but look at what happened to the wheat spreads last week. March SRW wheat fell 17 cents on the week. March HRW wheat fell 30 cents on the week. And it got down to a 3.5 cent spread between those winter wheat markets. Really a phenomenal move in that spread. March spring wheat futures last week down 45 cents.
USDA Friday morning announced the sale of just over 100,000 metric tons of U.S. corn for delivery to Mexico in the current marketing year. South Korea was also a buyer of nearly 200,000 metric tons of optional origin corn. Both good signs that export demand is increasing with old crop futures below $6. The demand helped to support corn prices, but the real focus seemed to be on Argentine weather. Conditions were super hot and dry last week. March futures opened steady and dipped to match support at Thursday's low before rallying to post a high range close. At Friday's close, March corn futures 8 3/4 cents higher, 596 1/4. May corn up 7 3/4, 597 1/4. July corn futures closed at 593 1/2, up 5 3/4 cents, Chip.
March contract just under $6 on Friday's close, 596 1/4. If we can climb back on top of that, may be able to build some upside momentum.
The unpredictability of a weather market in soybeans was on full display in soybeans last week. Thursday's refusal of March bean futures to trade through resistance of $14 resulted in a low-range close, and Friday saw follow-through selling and a new weekly low in front-month beans. Uncertainty over the weather forecast limited selling, and crop watchers noted the forecast does not include the chance for widespread drought-breaking rains. Right. USDA Friday announced the sale of 100,000 metric tons of U.S. soybean meal for delivery to Spain in the 22-23 marketing year. That sale didn't do much to support meal or bean prices. March beans 7 1/2 cents lower, 13.69 3/4. May beans down 7 3/4 cents, 13.79 1/2. July closed at 13.86. That's down 8 3/4.
Weather market for this week. There's just no question about that.
Well, not only did March cotton futures post a new contract high Friday, the contract opened steady and dipped through support at Thursday's low before recovering to close well above that day's high for an impressive upside reversal. March cotton 286 points higher, 119.70. July cotton up 122 points, 113.36. Livestocks. Strength in corn futures pushed feeder cattle futures lower, but spillover support from strong gains in hog prices helped live cattle futures close higher. February fat cattle 97 1/2 cents higher, 137.97 1/2. March feeders down 35 cents, 166.37 1/2. And on the snout side, front month lean hog futures spent the first 4 days of last week below resistance at $80 and rallied through that pivotal level by mid-morning Friday from tightening market hog inventories. Feb hogs 305 higher Friday, 80.90. April hogs up 312 1/2 to 88.45 on Friday's close, Chip.
Yeah, very good. Thank you, Davis. Appreciate that. And watch that January 4 downside price gap in February cattle. That's going to be a very important marker for that market going forward. Okay, we've got a conversation with Dr. Michael Cordonier, South American Crops, coming up next on AgriTalk.
Find farm equipment on Machine Repeat's January 18th online auction. No reserve, no buyer fees. Start bidding now. Auctions.machinerypeat.com.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Flory. Glad that you could join us on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Markets are closed, but AgriTalk is still up and running. We've got the info wide open and flowing in your direction. Glad that you could be here with us this morning, especially because I've got a very long friend on the show with me this morning. It is Dr. Michael Cordonier. Michael, it's good to talk with you again. How are you?
I'm doing fine. It's always glad to talk to you, Chip.
Yeah, I'm glad that we've got this opportunity to do this. And Michael, of course, is the crop consultant, both South American and U.S. crop consultant for Pro Farmer. And Michael and I believe we started working together, geez, was it 96, 97, something like that, Michael?
It was a long time ago.
Okay. Yeah, that's probably just the safest way of saying it. And I've learned so much from Michael and his insights into what is happening, what is actually happening in South America over the years. So I appreciate that. I want to start with this. I want to start with this because when I was looking at the yield maps for the U.S., Michael, it struck me the year-to-year changes on a percentage basis from 2020 to 2021 for corn production, for corn yields, and for soybean yields on a state-by-state basis. And you see that and you think to yourself, my gosh, how can it be such a different growing season in the Northwest than it was in the middle of the country than it was in the East? But I think that helps us understand the kind of crazy growing season that we're seeing down in Brazil this year, Michael. It's just nuts, isn't it?
I think the split is even more pronounced in Brazil than it was in the United States last summer.
Crazy.
In Brazil, this La Nina pattern, it took a while to take effect. You know, we thought it was going to start in September, October. It didn't start, And then it came on with a vengeance in November and December and continues into January. In central northern Brazil, there are multiple states with declarations of emergency, floods, breached dams, washed out roads, washed out bridges. The farmers up there have complained. They haven't seen the sun in about 2 months. It's been constantly overcast, heavy rains, record amounts in some areas. So that's just been a real deluge in the northern part of the country. Yeah. And compare that to the southern part of Brazil, Paraná, Rio Grande do Sul, Mato Grosso do Sul, those areas, they have done just the opposite. They have been in a prolonged drought. There's areas in Paraná, for example, western Paraná, they haven't had a rain in like 60 days, 2 months. Mm. And this is the hottest time of the year. So yeah. The sun is directly above your head, very clear skies. The sun is really punishing. And the result has been just a horrendous drought in part of the country. So one area is flooding and the other area is in severe drought.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to talk more about the drought and the impacts of that, but talk more about what's happening in that northern area, because where are they in the development of that crop? What kind of risks are we looking at because of the soggy conditions?
Okay, in the northern areas, they're just starting to harvest some of the early planted soybeans.
Okay.
And it's a little slow getting started because of the wet weather, but it looks like the weather's now starting to dry off a bit, and I'm sure the combines will be rolling in places like Mato Grosso and Goiás. Now, some of the early yields are good, maybe not quite as good as the farmers had expected, but still good. And I am still concerned that some of the top-end yields may be taken off because of that lack of sunshine over the last couple of months. Now, we see this happen before in Brazil. There's also reports in Mato Grosso of white mold and white flies, and U.S. farmers can relate to that. The problem with the white mold is they can't get in to spray because the fields are too wet.
Yeah.
And you can't do aerial application. You got to get the fungicide down at the bottom of the plant. So we'll see how that develops. And white flies just kind of getting started, but they're more of a dry type of situation than a wet type of situation.
Huh.
So they will, if it dries out, they will be harvesting full force in a week or two in Mato Grosso and central Brazil.
Okay. Okay. Harvest quality, anything? Do we need to be concerned about that at this time?
Well, I've seen reports of seeds rotted inside the pods, which you would expect.
So, yeah.
When it stays wet, and some sprouting in the pods as well. Yeah. It's not a catastrophe, all right?
Okay.
It might be in certain fields where the guy sprayed the desiccant and then couldn't get in to harvest when it came the right time and it kept raining. So there is some concern there as well. But I would say overall, it's not a nationwide yield reduction type of situation.
Yeah, blend it off, right?
Correct. Exactly right. Blend it off. Exactly right.
I don't think there's anybody better in the world than a Brazilian farmer when it comes to blending off some of those, because it seems like they've got it's a problem someplace almost every year that they run into too wet at harvest.
That's right. That's why they like to divide their maturities. The early ones, maybe 90, 95 day, and then 110 day, then 120 day. So you're not harvesting all at the same time, because that's a really, really big risk. If you want to harvest everything the second week of January, and it might be wet the whole week of the second week of January. So you split your maturities.
Gotcha. Okay. So take us back down to the southern part of Brazil where this intense drought. I mean, when I hear that, the development of the crop, where are they at this time? I mean, can the rains that seem to be slipping their way into the forecast, can they make a difference at this time?
They could help the later maturing soybeans.
Okay.
Especially in Rio Grande do Sul, which was planted later. So the beans in Rio Grande do Sul are now flowering, setting pods. They could be helped with rain. Up in Paraná, it's only going to help a small part of the soybeans in that state. Most of the soybeans are grown in the western northern part of the state. It's been extremely hot, extremely dry. The soybeans there are being harvested. In some statewide, I think they're maybe 2, 3, 4% harvested. In some municipalities, they may be 20%. Now, the maturity has been speeded up by the drought. So farmers are saying, I'm harvesting 20 days earlier than what I thought I would because the beans just dried down and died. And early yields in western Paraná are, I even kind of hate to say this, just abysmally low, from like 5 or 6 bushels up to maybe low 20s. And some fields were just abandoned. The farmers just mowed it down with a rotary mower so they could go out and plant safrinha corn and get that in the ground before the rain comes and hopefully make up their soybean losses with a good safrinha corn crop. So the early yields are really, really bad. The whole state has been declared a state of emergency in Paraná. Same thing for southern Mato Grosso do Sul. Same thing for most of Rio Grande do Sul. The Minister of Agriculture has been there last week. They're looking at the damage, trying to help the farmers. And the farm organizations say the way you can help us is to allow us to renegotiate our production loans from the government and maybe loans with the input suppliers to help us financially get through this really, really tough spot. So it's and it's like 2 years in a row now that part of Brazil.
Yep, that's right. Take a minute and tell me about the corn crop down there in southern Brazil. What the development stage and how it's been hurt?
Okay, the first crop of corn in southern Brazil, it's way past any help. It's finishing up. It's close to maturity. So early yields are really, really bad. Same way for the soybeans. Some of the early corn is just mowed down. It wasn't worth harvesting. Now, the early crop of corn, the two big states are Paraná, where they've been the two big states are Rio Grande do Sul, where the yields are really, really, really bad, and Minas Gerais, a little bit further north. And up in Minas, there's been plenty of rain. So the first crop of corn is doing fine up there, probably have above normal type of yields. But the first crop of corn in Rio Grande do Sul is terrible, abysmal.
Okay.
So you kind of have a split decision there as well.
Okay. All right. Well, we know that first crop of corn out of Brazil is important, but it's not as important as the safrinha corn crop, the second corn crop. When we come back, we're going to have that conversation. What's the outlook for that? And let's get to USDA's estimates that we got last week on Brazilian corn and soybean production. We need to talk a little bit about Argentina and where things are going in the future in South America. Dr. Michael Cordonier, right here on AgriTalk.
On this observance of Martin Luther King Jr. Day, an excerpt from Dr. King's letter from a Birmingham jail. Sometimes a law is just on its face and unjust in its application. For instance, I have been arrested on a charge of parading without a permit. Now, there is nothing wrong with having an ordinance which requires a permit for a parade, but such an ordinance becomes unjust when it is used to maintain segregation and to deny citizens the First Amendment privilege of peaceful assembly and protest. I hope you are able to see the distinction I am trying to point out. In no sense do I advocate evading or defying the law, as would the rabid segregationist. That would lead to anarchy. One who breaks an unjust law must do so openly, lovingly, and with a willingness to accept the penalty. I submit that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for law. Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Flory. Glad that you can be with us today. Markets are closed. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. But we've got the information flowing to you with Dr. Michael Cordonier. I mentioned earlier that Dr. Michael is the crop consultant for Pro Farmer, also runs a service called Soybean and Corn Advisor, been doing that for a long time. Michael, last segment, we talked about the first corn crop in Brazil. Give me the outlook for the second corn crop and talk about why it's more important.
Yeah, the first corn crop in Brazil accounts for about 25% of all Brazil's corn production. And all that corn is used exclusively in the livestock industry in southern Brazil, where it's grown.
Okay.
Now, the safrinha crop accounts for 75%, and that is grown mostly in central Brazil, especially Mato Grosso and Goiás, also some grown in Paraná, and that's the corn that goes into export. Now, right. Everyone is concerned about fertilizer prices and how it might affect, you know, safrinha corn production. One thing you got to remember, the domestic corn price in Brazil is really, really strong because they've been short on corn now for going into 2 years. So domestic prices are really strong. Yes, farmers are concerned about fertilizer prices, and some have complained that they didn't get the fertilizer they ordered or it's delayed or they got a different formulation from what they ordered. They still got some time. You can plant until the end of February, but everyone thinks that the safrinha corn acre is going to go up because you can make a lot of money on safrinha corn. And they're going to have it planted in the right planting window. So I think they're going to increase the corn acreage for safrinha. And it looks like they're going to at least start the season with lots of soil moisture, especially up in central Brazil.
Yeah.
That may not be the case in Paraná, but you know, if they get some moisture later on, it still could do fine. So I think the safrinha crop is yet to be determined, but everybody's optimistic about that crop going forwards.
Okay, well, let's take a look at what USDA has done with the crop estimates out of Brazil. And we'll talk corn first. In December, USDA had the Brazilian crop at 118 million ton. They took 3 million ton off it, down to 115 million ton. It seems a little conservative to me.
Yes, and I know why. They're saying, listen, we got three quarters of the crop yet to go, not even planted yet, so why get too crazy too early? I'm at 112 for Brazilian corn. So they're conservative. I have no problem with that. But most market analysts are below that in the market. But we all have to kind of tread the water here, wait and see how the safrinha crop turns out.
Yeah, yeah, okay. On Argentina, we haven't talked a whole lot about conditions in Argentina, but in Argentina, they've got the crop at 54 million tons. That's off from 54.5 in December. And I believe it lines up really good. Well, no, a year ago, they grew 50.5. So they're still looking at a crop better than a year ago, right?
Well, they were really conservative for Argentina.
Okay.
But the situation in Argentina is dire, and that's being kind. They have had record high temperatures lately, just unbelievable temperatures. You know, I'll go a little bit further back. At the start of the season, September, October, most of November, Argentina was getting just-in-time rains. You know, kept everything going kind of good, but then it just come Christmas, you know, before Christmas, it just turned off. It's got very hot, very dry since. Now, you know, some rains now will help the second planting of corn. But the first planting of corn, it's already toast. And now that first planting is maybe 35%, 40% of the total corn. The second crop of corn, they're still planting. So they still got, you know, maybe 15, 20% left to plant. And it remains to be seen if they plant all that intended corn acres. Same thing for soybeans. You know, they're planting a double crop now in Argentina. And there are people, including myself, I don't think they're going to plant all the second crop soybeans. Because like they say in the United States, if it's dry, don't even try. Well, it's very dry and very hot in Argentina. And they got maybe 2 weeks to plant. And after that, it gets very, very risky. So I think there may be 200,000-400,000 hectares of soybeans that may not get planted. So for the corn estimate from the USDA, they were very conservative in Argentina, okay. Very conservative.
Okay, let's talk soybeans on USDA estimates. USDA took Brazil from 144 million tons down to 139 million tons. A year ago, we did 138 million tons. What's your attitude there?
They're very conservative. I have Brazil beans at 135 with a lower bias. It's a tough call this year because you're going to have good yields up north, terrible yields down south. Now, how do you rectify the two? I would say they are some of the highest estimates in the market, USDA and CONAB, for that fact. And okay. I don't fault them. Their job is to tell us what has been, not what will be. Our job is to look forward, to kind of speculate forwards.
Right.
That's not their job. So
right.
They're conservative, but hey, that's what they're supposed to do.
Yep. Okay. Talk to me about soybeans in Argentina then. USDA 46.5 down from 49.5 in December. A year ago, 46.2.
Well, you know, I'm at 43. A lot of people are in the 40 million ton range in Argentina. See, the Argentine soybeans, they don't have two crops like the corn split between early and late. They just have one. So, and that one crop is being hurt severely by adverse weather. So I think they're conservative there as well. And I expect all their numbers for South America to come down in the next report.
Okay. All right, good. We've got a little bit of time to just kind of reflect on some things, Michael, because I want to go back to where we started this conversation. And that was the split growing season that we had in the U.S. We've also got a split growing season in Brazil and South America. I don't know how many times over the last 25 years, Michael, that you and I have talked about what happens in the U.S. then happens in South America, or what happens in South America then happens in the U.S.
It's
almost like we see repeated growing seasons, and it feels like it's going to happen again.
I call it the mirror image.
Yeah.
If you get a picture of the globe with North and South America and the weather pattern, it's like a mirror image. And when you think about it, we're both influenced by the Pacific Ocean water temperature. Both hemispheres have a mountain range on the west side. Both hemispheres, the weather moves west to east for most of the area. So it's like a mirror image. But the tricky part is always to say, okay, are we the leading edge or the trailing edge,
right,
so to speak, of the conditions? But we had this split in the United States last year. Now they got this split in South America this year.
Yeah. It's something that we're going to have to watch because it's I'm not sure where we are in the order of things, Michael, if the U.S. is showing
right.
us what South America is going to be, or if South America is showing us what the U.S. is going to be. I'm not sure where we're at in the order of everything, but it's really it is really something to watch and observe. Tell me about the next 3 to 5 years in Brazil. What happens?
Well, you know, soybean acreage has gone up in Brazil like 15, 16 straight years. It's going to continue to go up. The demand for soybeans is there, especially for renewable diesel and all this sort of stuff. We're going to need more soybean oil, all that sort of thing. Most of the increasing acreage comes from the conversion of pastures to row crops. Now, they had a really good year last year. Prices are unbelievably high domestically. Good prices again. So it's going to continue to expand, without a doubt. And that almost automatically increases safrinha corn acres because the corn acres follow soybeans. So as you increase the soybean, you increase the safrinha corn acreage. But here's the difference for corn. They're starting to use a lot more corn in Brazil for ethanol production. In the state, I should say, in Brazil in general, there's now 19 ethanol plants that use corn. You know, 4 or 5 years ago, there was zero, and they're building them as fast as they can. And with the very high prices, everybody asked me, well, how can you afford to make ethanol from corn at these high corn prices? It's because you have to worry about the transportation cost if you take ethanol from southern Brazil and transport it by truck up to central Brazil to blend into your gasoline. So it's just easier to make the ethanol where you're going to use it, and you avoid all that transportation cost in Brazil. So even at these high domestic corn prices, it is just Katie bar the door. They're building these corn ethanol plants as fast as they can in central Brazil.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Can they handle more bushels? They're making investments in their infrastructure all the time. Of course they can handle more bushels, right?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. Now, the infrastructure investment, like railroads, it's slow, and it just takes a long time, but they are slowly, and that's the key word here, slowly improving the rail structure. They did improve highways. That's easier to do than rail. In fact, Highway 163, heading north out of Mato Grosso to the Amazon.
Yep.
It's all asphalted now. The trucks are rolling. It's really going to push more and more of their exports to Amazon ports, which are closer and cheaper and closer to the end user as well.
Right.
So they are
right.
making some slow improvements.
Yep. Very interesting. Michael, you know what? Thank you for all these years of friendship and all the information that you have shared with me and with Pro Farmer members and listeners of AgriTalk. Good stuff, man. Thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure. I always enjoy doing it. And if anybody ever has any questions, just feel free to contact me if they want. And very easy. My email address is soycorn, SOYCORN, @comcast.net. I'll be glad to answer any of their questions.
Outstanding. Dr. Michael Cordonier, Soybean and Corn Advisor. Davis and I will be back to wrap up AgriTalk here in a moment.
Our name says it all. AgriTalk. What more do you need to know?
Welcome back to AgriTalk on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Glad that you could be with us. Markets were closed, of course. Going to be reopening this evening for Tuesday's session. And a lot of what is going to take place in that market is going to be dependent on the weather conditions over the weekend and what we were talking about with Dr. Michael Cordonier. Davis, it is a huge weather market that we're going to be looking at here, at least for the near term, in corn and soybeans, man, and something that we got to pay attention to. It turned into a really big thing a year ago, and if we would happen to lose another, heck, if we would lose another 150 million bushels of the Brazilian second corn crop, Davis, that has a major impact on all. On the U.S. export outlook going forward, man. It just will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure.
Yep, no
we'll
doubt.
Keep an eye on it. It's lucky we got Dr. C around.
That's right. Okay, hey, it is Monday, and it's Monday afternoon. That means that it's time to get a chart update. We've got Kerry Artak coming your way from Artak Advisory Service.
Yeah, thanks for having me again, Chip. I'm going to start with February lean hogs. I want to mention the lean hog market because it's coming into an important rollover in the next couple of weeks. February is trading around 80.90, April 88.45. That was Friday's closes. And there's an important pivot point on the weekly continuation charts. And I use volume-based rollover. So when April exceeds February volume in the next week or two, it will be reflected on the long-term charts where we deem and find the long-term trends. And 86.55 has been an important pivot point for me for months now. It's a horizontal channel top on the weekly chart, pretty well defined. It is the ceiling for February. February trading around 80.90. Any approaches to 86.55, I've been telling subscribers, are good opportunities to set hedges into spring. We could fall from 86.55 back into the low 70s within several months, perhaps. But closing above 86.55 should launch a pretty aggressive buy signal into spring, summer. And so when we roll to April in a week or two, April is much higher, and we may actually roll April at 88.45, may actually roll above 86.55. And I do respect the rollover-based buy signal. So if we do close any week above 86.55, and this could be actually in a few weeks when we roll to April and April happens to settle above 86.55, and then we've got a buy signal, I think, in the order of 3 to 5 months, 91.40, quick 2 to 3 week target, 97.55 within 2 to 3 months. And I think as we continue into summer trade or late spring, we could reach the 103.30 area if we close above 86.55. I will note that holding above 72.05 will keep 103.30 in reach by some point later this year, but it's the close above 86.55, and it may well be April that puts this out in a couple of weeks. Until then, if April rolls below 86.55, it may, April contract, fall back into the lower 70s itself by expiration. On to March cotton. You know, we had the big buy signal in August that followed through September, October, put out the November high, and we've been kind of in this kind of wide swinging, a two-sided framework in cotton for the last, you know, few months. And still, though, bullish above 90.89 long-term, that is well below the market. Cotton is trading in the upper 10s, you know, right now. It actually closed Friday, if we're talking March contract, at 119.70. And this is an important area right now, 120.10. That's our pivot point for the broader cotton market, and that'll be the March contract. So if March can close above 120.10 on Friday, it enters another buying phase. And maybe in as little as 3 to 5 weeks, we reach the next objective at 134.03, because I would expect, you know, price acceleration if that were to occur. Until then, continued weekly settlements below 120.10 allow March cotton to fall back over the next few months to 101.50, where it finds meaningful midterm support. We could trade inside the 101.50 to 120.10 area for several months. But if we close above 120.10, we have bullish trend resumption, 134.03, then expected within several months and quite possibly within 3 to 5 weeks, where the broader cotton market can actually top out through spring. And finally, February heating oil, soon to be March. I'd mentioned in your last show a few weeks ago how 2.1478 was long-term support that we'd been testing and above which 2.9150 would be likely into summer. Well, we've had some aggressive gains in heating oil the last 3 or 4 weeks. And in fact, the February contract closed above the October high, which was the move high prior to that, of 2.6080. And so I think we may be just about 3 to 5 weeks away from reaching that 2.9150 target. It's actually 2.9144. It drops ever so slightly, can contain buying actually on an annual basis. But if we were to close above 2.9144, it's not going to happen this week, but say between now and the end of February, we launch into another 3 to 5 month buy signal where I would expect 3.62 as we continue into spring, summer. And that's all I've got for today, Chip. Thanks for having me again.
Thank you, Kerry. Good stuff, man. Don't forget, everybody, that Kerry Artak has a free trial available for you. Just go to Artak, that's A-R-T-A-C, advisory.com, and ask Kerry for that free 2-week trial of his daily service, and he'll get you hooked up there. Davis, we're all going to be on the road on Tuesday. This rarely happens.
Yes, it rarely does. And the deal is, there was so much talk of grits this week. I just got to head somewhere south. Paducah, Kentucky is as far south as I'm going to go. It's as far south as I can justify going. And while I'm there, I'm going to talk with some of the good folks at Murray State, both the morning and afternoon shows on Tuesday, tomorrow. be from Murray State. I'm looking forward to it. Yeah. It's going to be a blast.
Well, you guys are going to dig deep into the soybean industry there in the state of Kentucky.
You guys believe it.
Yeah. Yeah. It will be very, very interesting to see exactly what these guys have got planned. So looking forward to those conversations. I'm going to be going in the opposite direction. I'll be meeting with the fine people up in Eau Claire, Wisconsin on Tuesday. I'll get to see my friend Brian Winnikins up there from WRDN in Durand, Wisconsin. Right. So look forward to that. Hey, we've got the shows that are coming your way the rest of this week. They are so important. But, guys, stay focused on the volatility in these grain markets. Stay focused on the weather forecast. Know that it's coming. Know that it's coming and be prepared for it. Be safe out there. We'll talk to you again tomorrow morning right here on AgriTalk.